Hello, and welcome to Radio New Internationalist. Each week in this program, New Internationalists from around the world explore the people, the ideas, and the action in the fight for global justice. In a moment, campaigners and progressive thinkers will start dropping in. They'll be bringing us stories and experiences that are too often missed by mainstream media. How guns are being killed off. Why arms traders get away with murder. And where an army invaded through bikini-clad women. I'm Chris Richards from New Internationalist magazine. As mid-July marks the moment for our governments to report to the United Nations about their marriage to small arms, today we thought we'd explore why the world loves those small, cold, grey weapons of mass destruction, guns, and how people and countries can get a divorce. And who better to join us on this discovery tour than Rebecca Peters? Rebecca is the director of the International Action Network on Small Arms, a global movement of 800 civil society organisations working in 120 countries to get rid of small arms and light weapons. And we need to get rid of guns, urgently. 1,000 people die every day from gunshot wounds and 3,000 are severely injured. And it's not troops that are targeted, it's mostly civilians. Nearly three quarters of guns are in the hands of civilians, not armies. And three quarters of people who die are citizens, not soldiers. If 1,000 people were dying each day from bird flu, it'd be treated as a global emergency. So why don't governments just pass laws to outlaw guns, Rebecca?
Well, it's partly because they have a love affair with guns, which is based in ideology, in ideas about masculinity. It's no coincidence that the vast majority of governments in the world are run by men, and more than 99% of people who use guns are men. And they see guns as a natural part of their life as men, but also as a natural part of life as governments. And they think that the huge number of people who are killed and injured by guns each day is just a normal part of life as well. And so our task is to convince governments and individuals around the world that gun violence is preventable and that we have some proven solutions that are really working.
And we'd like to talk about those proven solutions throughout this program, Rebecca. But I'm just wondering, it's a crime to have drugs in your possession because they can hurt people. What do governments say to you about guns?
Well, the problem is that all governments see guns as having a legitimate use in their own arsenals. Half of the countries in the world manufacture guns, and all countries in the world are consumers or users of guns. And so from the point of view of governments, if you want to have national security, then you must have guns. And there's an old idea that the more guns you have, the safer your country would be. Governments are very attached to their own arsenals of guns, and also government officials are very tied in to the arms industry. Also, a lot of governments make money from selling guns. In many countries, the arms industry is partly owned by the government. And so they see it as a legitimate part of governments to have large quantities of guns, and they also see it as legitimate for there to be large arsenals outside government in the civilian communities. And in that sense, it's very different from drugs. The comparison with drugs is also important because drugs are very difficult to control, partly because they're illegal from the moment of their creation all the way through to their use. But guns are all manufactured legally. And that means that at some point in their lives, they are under the control of government. And the challenge for us is to make sure that they stay under control and don't make their way into the wider population.
Your organisation is arming civil society to disarm communities through a lot of creative ways. And there's many ways to attack guns. First, there's the love affair that men seem to have with them that you've just touched on. Because they're long, slim, hard and penetrating, they've been likened to penile. What's your take on why they are so popular, Rebecca? Do you think that has traction, that analogy?
I actually don't put that much stock by the idea of the shape of guns, but what we do know is that a gun can turn a person who is not physically strong into a person who has the power to destroy and to intimidate other people. I do think it's true that throughout the world, a lot of men are insecure about their power as men, and having a gun in their hands makes it possible for men to feel more powerful. But also, there is an old idea that the role of a man was to be at the ready to do violence to protect his family or to protect his country, and that that was how a man could distinguish himself. And I think that that is still very prevalent in many societies, even though nowadays we know that the best way to sort out problems is not simply by doing damage to another person or by threatening them with damage. And likewise, at the level of governments, the best way to sort out your problems with other countries is to try to work out incentives, economic ways, political negotiation. And we recognize that the person who has the most physical strength is not necessarily the person who should win the argument.
As you're speaking, I'm thinking though that negotiation assumes a level of education, and higher levels of education are prevalent within societies that are richer. Does this mean that guns are used more and are more rampant in the poor world?
Certainly, the vast majority of gun deaths and injuries occur in the poor world. The distribution of guns in terms of the uncontrolled proliferation is in the poor world, yes. And that's partly because the poor world is where there have been a lot of armed conflicts, either still going on or recently finished. And part of the stock of 875 million guns in the world are guns that have been left over from wars, from armed conflicts. And also, the poor world is the most affected by drug trafficking, by other forms of trafficking, which are often enforced with the use of guns as well. And also, in poor countries, the ability of the police and governments to enforce any kind of law is much, much weaker than in the rich world. But there are certainly places in the rich world, most notably the United States, where there is a huge concentration of guns. I mean, there's almost one gun for every human being in the US. And certainly we see that that is the country in the rich world which has by far the highest rate of gun death and injury.
And so, what's the comparison with, say, for instance, the United States and a country like Australia, where there's been a solid buyback of guns after a massacre at Port Arthur in Tasmania?
Australia is relatively typical of developed countries. In Australia, the rate of gun deaths is around about one or two per 100,000. In the US, the number is about 20 times that. So you can definitely see that something being done wrong in the US that's being done right in other developed countries. Very few countries have actually banned guns, but what they put in place is systems of licensing, of registration, basically the ability to try to screen out the most obviously inappropriate people who have guns, and the ability to take guns away from people who become unsuitable. There are only one or two countries in the world that actually do ban guns. Those countries are Mongolia and Malaysia, where it is pretty well prohibited to have a gun as a civilian.
And is there a correlation between that ban and the amount of injuries and death caused by gunshot wounds? There must be.
In general, the more easily accessible guns are, the more gun violence you see. And in particular, how easily accessible handguns are, which are pistols and revolvers, the guns that can be held in one hand, fired with one hand, those are the guns that are the weapons of choice for criminals. And they are guns designed specifically for killing people. The availability of handguns in a society does correlate quite closely with the rate of gun death and injury in that country.
Yes, I love the way that Brazil's handled this issue. They've taken on guns make you a man attitude, and they've really gone for it, haven't they? Your members have been particularly active in Brazil to actually try and break that attitude down. Tell us about that action and also its results.
Brazil has the distinction of being the country with the largest number of gun deaths in the world. And what has happened in Brazil has been a really comprehensive approach involving government and civil society to try to reduce gun violence and the availability of guns. From the point of view of our members in civil society, one of the most important aspects was addressing the question of demand for guns and trying to tackle that notion that a man with a gun is going to be more desirable to women and have more status among his friends. And our members have run a campaign using very well-known stars of the Brazilian soap operas. They're called the telenovelas. So these very glamorous women who have appeared in a series of advertisements saying things like, what is it with these men who think they need to have a gun? Maybe they have a little problem of some kind, and, you know, gesturing with their fingers to show a little problem as being something that's very short, or saying, choose your gun or me. And in Portuguese, as in many Latin languages, the noun for a gun is a feminine noun. And so the way that the advertisement runs is it says, choose her or me. So it's very much drawing on the fact that heterosexual relations in Brazil are at the heart of a lot of things. And that has been very useful for encouraging women to speak up as well. At the same time, there has been a whole package of policy reforms in Brazil. They looked at the problem, recognized certain risk factors. For example, certain age groups are particularly at risk. This is the case in all societies, that the highest rate of gun violence is committed, and also the largest concentration of victims can be found in the population of young men aged between 18 and 24. So one of the changes that was made in Brazil was it raised the minimum age to have a gun to 25.
That is so sensible, something like that. Why don't countries across the world do that?
Well, in fact, it's interesting that it does seem so obvious to try to skirt past the peak point in the life of young men when their control over their anger is at a low point and when their likelihood of getting into fights is at a high point. Increasingly, countries are. Recently, Germany changed the minimum age to have a gun to 25. And we've also seen other European countries increasingly raising their minimum age. Some of the other things that Brazil did was it introduced much tighter requirements for licensing. And Brazil has also banned the carrying of guns in public places. Two other things that were very important in Brazil, they held a huge buyback and destruction program for guns, where they said, here's your chance to get rid of that gun, bring it in, we'll pay you for it, and destroy the gun. And that program destroyed nearly 500,000 guns, which is gigantic. And the other thing was a huge national program of awareness raising, communicating to people the fact that having a gun in your house makes your house a dangerous place. And the result of all of those measures is that we have seen a dramatic reduction in gun deaths in Brazil.
To see how in practice disarmament can work in other parts of the world, let's go now to Cambodia. After 30 years of internal conflict there, guns were part of the household furniture. During the late 1970s, the Khmer Rouge, led by Pol Pot, tried to build a communist state with a farm-based economy. As the country was converted into a giant labour camp, executions and murder took over where overwork, starvation and illness failed. In just under 4 years, their policies killed 1.5 million people, over 20% of the population. So when Yukiko Marisaki arrived in Cambodia, she found guns everywhere. She's just dropped into our airwaves now. When you arrived, Yukiko, how did people describe their relationship to guns to you?
Well, when I arrived in Cambodia, it was not immediately after the war, so there were a lot of people who were not so gun-friendly, but still there were especially former military people who were uncomfortable of the idea of letting go of their weapons. They said that they knew that it was not a good thing to keep weapons now that they have peace, but they said that they still felt very uncomfortable letting them go, and they felt insecure, and that they needed guns to protect their families.
And I suppose that insecurity was built on what had happened before to them, Yukiko, that there wasn't any reliable security in the political and economic sense at all.
Yes, but there is also, in the post-war era, now that it is a little bit more politically stable, they still feel very economically unstable, and there's still a lot of crimes, and they're still very afraid of many things, and they don't feel confident with the police or the government. They don't feel that they're protected, so that they think that only they themselves can protect themselves. They don't really have a lot of trust in other people.
So how many people were we talking about who owned guns?
Some research has been done that said that as a country as a whole, there was about 25,000 to 70,000 or something, and that's a huge gap, but it's very difficult to actually get the correct numbers.
And what kind of environment did that create, the fact that there could be up to 75,000 guns in a fairly small population in civilian hands?
Well, there was really a culture of violence that people would take their weapons to solve their problems when there's a dispute with a neighbour or if they want to steal something.
Really, even a neighbourhood dispute, the guns would come out, would they?
Yeah, and quite personal level disputes, like family disputes as well. That's quite often in the news, actually. Even if they don't actually fire, it's a lot of intimidation there. So it does help the community become really unstable.
You work with the Japan Assistance Team for Small Arms Management in Cambodia. How many guns did you and your colleagues collect?
We worked in 5 provinces. It's not the whole country, but in total, we collected about 28,000 small arms.
Wow, that's a huge amount.
It is, and these were weapons that were actually voluntarily surrendered, so we didn't go up and say, give in your guns. The point was to have them surrender their guns voluntarily to the police and for them to express their trust to the police also.
I suppose the trust bit comes before the giving over your guns. So how do you get people to do that? What kind of community initiatives did you put into place that enabled people to feel comfortable to give up their guns?
It's a really confidence-building activities, and it's a complex thing, but what we do is we really try to build networks, first to involve the police or the community leaders or administrative leaders to commit into the scheme, and also the people who really are pro-peace. There's always in the community people who don't want the weapons, who don't like the people who have the weapons, and we try to give them a bigger voice and encourage them to speak up. And we really try to make the community have this atmosphere of anti-weapons. So what we do is we do workshops and encourage a lot of participants. But when we do these workshops, like old people, they would come up and tell their story about weapons, how it's not needed in the community. And usually people like them, they don't really have a big voice in the communities, but we provide a place where they could express their ideas and share their ideas about their safety and their security problems. And also, we provide a place where the police and the community can discuss their problems and how they could have a constructive relationship for the community security. And we can't do all these workshops in all the areas in Cambodia, obviously, but what happened was some of the police people would say that this was a very good idea and they would like to do it in other areas as well so that they could strengthen their community security program.
Some of this type of stuff is quite straightforward, isn't it? It's about a community speaking to each other and acknowledging each other and how each other wants to live. I noticed that one of the things you were doing was building bonfires to burn off guns. Tell us about those ceremonies.
What we do is we build a big bonfire of the weapons that we collect in that community, and we invite all the police, community leaders, the civilians who surrendered the weapons, so the people could see that they actually what they surrendered is now destroyed and it's not going to be a threat to anyone else. It's quite extraordinary and it brings a lot of publicity within the country as well. But as an impact, we also did something called a peace monument project using the burnt weapons into a sculpture, and we put it up in public park. It's a beautiful piece of art, but people, when they see it, they could see that it's the weapons that were used to kill but were actually collected and destroyed and now is a form of art where people could think that they made a long transition.
Yes, but what about the people who have relied on guns so much? How can you help them mentally out of that culture? It isn't just about getting a louder voice from people with peace. It's also helping them to change their attitude to their neighbours and the way they see the state.
Well, that's really a tough question, actually. we really tried to convince them that maybe you might feel safe, but your children are not going to feel safe. Because having your own weapons, it really doesn't help your family, the people you love, your children, doesn't help your grandchildren. That is basically the approach we use. From a Cambodian culture, we don't really directly target their ideas, but we sort of try to go around it and say how really that it's not possible to keep weapons and enjoy peace and security.
That was Yukiko Murasaki talking about her work with the Japan Assistance Team for Small Arms Management in Cambodia, which finished last year. Yukiko, great to talk with you today. Thank you very much for joining the program.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Listening to Radio New Internationalist. I'm Chris Richards, sitting in Community Radio Station 3CR in Melbourne, Australia. And we're talking today about how the world is about to fire small arms. And talking of getting shot, this program's taken a couple during the last few weeks. The Radio New Internationalist team love linking you up each week with people across the globe to bring you in-depth news and views that you won't hear elsewhere. However, a funding grant for the program has just fallen through. No cash means no program. Unless we get a substantial injection of money over the coming weeks, we're going to have to close down. So if you listen to this program regularly and like what you hear, could you support us by giving us some money to keep producing this program for you? No amount is too small, or for that matter, too big. Just head to the New Internationalist website, www.newint.org, and click on Radio New Internationalist. I'm Chris Richards, and today we're talking with Rebecca Peters from the International Action Network on Small Arms. Rebecca, one of the ways to stop the guns is to stop the lines of profit. Can you give us a bit of an overview of the trade in small arms at the moment?
Sure. The majority of small arms manufacturing occurs in developed countries. The largest producer and exporter is the United States, but there are also very significant exports of small arms from the global south. Brazil, South Africa, China, Russia is a big one. And increasingly, the trade is very globalized. Often, components of small arms will be made in one country, shipped to another country, and assembled into the weapon system. Some regions of the world have codes of conduct or regional agreements to try to stop guns going into conflict zones or to countries where human rights are a problem. But because of globalization, the manufacturers are able to get around those agreements by simply opening a subsidiary in a country that's not covered by the agreement. Basically, the trade is globalized, and therefore we are pushing for a global treaty to regulate international arms transfers, which will be called, we hope, the Arms Trade Treaty.
I'd like to talk about that treaty and what its substance is, Rebecca, but tell us about how much profit there is in this at the moment and who's making it.
One of the most distressing aspects of this issue is that guns are extremely durable products. So we see the guns that were surplus in the armies of the Soviet Union at the end of the Cold War, hundreds of millions of them were exported to Africa. We know, for example, that guns that were used in the conflict in Liberia were then moved on and used in the conflict in Sierra Leone, and the killing power does not diminish. And so the traders and brokers can get additional profit time and again from the same weapons. And the people who are making those sales are often brokers based in Europe. They are specialists at getting around the laws in particular countries, and they often own aircraft. They have bank accounts in the Caribbean, and they have very, very complicated business arrangements designed specifically to prevent detection. The profits actually from this industry are not so high considering how much destruction it causes. The value of the industry is worth about $5 billion US dollars a year.
Gee, that sounds incredibly small, actually.
Yeah, and that's the thing about guns. It's not like the big weapons, you know, missile systems and those things that are worth billions and billions. Guns are basically cheap, and that's part of why they are such a problem. Because they're relatively cheap, they're within the ability of a lot of people to buy. But because they're a product that can be sold again and again, so the brokers are able to make money again and again off the same product.
It's extraordinary. If the profits aren't large and guns are killing so many people, why don't governments just say the arms trade treaty that you were talking about, why aren't governments just signing up and saying, yep, we'll put up our hands for this?
The idea of the arms trade treaty is it will be an international treaty that will prohibit international transfers of guns and other conventional weapons to buyers in situations where either those weapons are likely to come into the hands of people who shouldn't have them, like militias, or that the weapons are likely to be used in human rights abuses. You might think that governments of the world would say, right on, we don't want weapons to be diverted, and we don't want weapons to be used in human rights abuses. But of course, governments of the world are all concerned that they might find it more difficult to get weapons. And because about half of all the governments in the world are involved in selling guns, they realize that inevitably some of those sales are to places where, under the Arms Trade Treaty, the sale would be stopped. To their credit, we had a resolution in the General Assembly in the United Nations in 2006 to begin work developing a treaty. And the majority of governments said, yes, let's begin the discussion. Now there's a process in the United Nations of experts thinking about how would the treaty be applied. And that's where we're seeing a lot of governments saying, whoa, we need to be cautious. We need to make sure that the treaty doesn't interfere with legitimate arms sales. And so part of our job as civil society is to say to governments, look, you're not making that much money from the sale of these weapons anyway. You'll be better off if you forego sales of weapons.
I mean, to put the contrary argument, the hospital costs of countries from dealing with people who have been injured and killed through guns must be enormous.
Indeed, in a couple of places it has been calculated. So, for example, in Colombia, it's estimated that the cost that gun violence imposes on the social and health and legal systems of Colombia is about $4 billion a year. The entire value of the small arms trade is the same as the value of the damage done in one country.
That's incredible.
The other argument against or why some governments are cautious about the treaty is that they say that the major producers like the United States, Russia, and China are not likely to sign the treaty. And that's because the United States just doesn't tend to sign any treaties. And the other countries, Russia and China, the indications are that they are not likely to want to sign up. It's a legitimate question that other governments are asking. What is the use of a treaty if the major producers don't sign?
Absolutely. It's actually repeated in other types of conventions as well. And I'm thinking here on landmines, cluster bombs. So let's go now to Norway, where a friend of this program has just dropped in for a chat. John Rodsted is the official photographer to the international campaign to ban landmines, the team that won the 1997 Nobel Peace Prize. And he's still campaigning against the cruel and life-destroying legacy of war, the anti-personnel cluster bombs left behind. To give this weapon of mass destruction its death dues, cluster bombs caused more civilian casualties in Iraq at the beginning of the war there in 2003 than any other weapon. John's just been in Dublin, where over 100 countries have just committed to a ban on cluster munitions. Tell us about the good news, John.
Yeah, well, it's taken about a year to get to Dublin. The catalyst was the war in Lebanon in 2006, where 4 million cluster bombs were fired into southern Lebanon in the last 3 days of the conflict, and well over a million of them failed to explode. So that created a massive dangerous legacy for all the returning refugees. It was that impetus that got the Norwegian government to step up and say, we want to create a process that will work towards creating a comprehensive ban on these weapons. And that process began in February last year and it came to a head 2 weeks ago in Dublin, where we got over 111 countries turn up there to negotiate a treaty, and the treaty that has been negotiated is 95% fantastic.
So in terms of the US, which is always a stopper on this, Rebecca's just been talking about how the US is a stopper on the arms trade treaty as well. I understand that the US didn't even turn up to Dublin.
No, they didn't turn up, but they certainly were doing a lot of backroom deals. We were hearing from ambassadors and foreign affairs ministers from countries who were present, and they had literally been bullied by Condoleezza Rice, Bush and various others in the State Department, basically saying everything from if this treaty came about, there would be the end of NATO, there would be budget cuts. So we saw some fabulous strength come out, particularly from the African and the South American nations. They really stood tough against this kind of intimidation.
And when you say they stood tough, was that because they were saying to the US, look, this just has to go through?
That's basically what they did. They said, we're not going to be intimidated by your own agenda. Our agenda is we know what it's like to be on the receiving end of these things. We don't give these to people. We receive them from the likes of yourselves or who you supply these weapons to. So they really fought hard for a comprehensive ban.
So the treaty is about to be ratified in December this year. You need 30 countries to ratify it. What do you think the effects of it will be once it is ratified? John, what are you hoping for and what do you expect will actually happen?
Start with what happens is the treaty opens for signature on the 2nd of December. So we want as many countries to turn up and sign the treaty as possible. But they don't have to just sign on the first day. I mean, the treaty is then open permanently. And you've got to then keep negotiating with countries to slowly but surely universalise the entire treaty. That's what we did with the Landmines Treaty. We're up to 156 countries signed onto that now. So landmines largely in the last decade have become a thing that's been relegated to a history book. Now we need to do the same with cluster bombs to get as many nations there as to sign the treaty, then those nations need to go home and then ratify it, which basically means enshrine the legal obligations of the treaty into their national legislation. Now, as soon as 30 countries ratify it, then the treaty goes into force. And we're hoping to see it go into force by the first third of next year.
So do we have figures now on landmines? That ban on landmines has been in place for a while now. And as you said, there's more and more countries signing every day. So it's not an actually global ban as yet.
The big picture with landmines is that every click that was fought prior to 1997, landmines were just part of the arsenals of the military and they were used. So whenever a war was fought, landmines were put in the ground, they stayed in the ground, they never went away. Now, since that treaty's happened, rapidly we started to see a change in the use of mines in conflicts. And now it's such a stigmatised weapon system. As far as I know, the only countries that have used mines in recent years has been Nepal and Burma. And even in the case of the United States, who haven't signed the treaty, they haven't used a landmine in battle since 1991. The stigma on the weapon is too great, and they would certainly be seen as being very belligerent against all their NATO partners. So the knock-on effect is actually very strong.
I'd like to bring Rebecca Peters from the International Action Network on Small Arms into our conversation now. Rebecca, in ridding the world of small arms, how effective do you think a convention like the one John's been describing could be? After all, cluster bombs are technically small arms, aren't they?
Yes, actually they are, but they have their own characteristics enough to justify their own treaty. But I'm jealous of the cluster munitions treaty campaign because on our issue we have a couple of other things that make it harder, which is that governments have yet to accept that there should be a limitation on the numbers or the types of guns that they should use or should export and import. The treaty we're looking for will be a treaty regulating the international transfer of small arms to stop transfers which create a risk of human rights abuses and will contribute to undermining sustainable development or breaches of international humanitarian law. And we definitely expect that when we do get a treaty, the US will not sign up to it. We don't imagine that Russia will sign up to it. But we expect to see an effect kind of like with landmines, that if most countries do sign up, then the market will be reduced. And the countries that have not signed up, they will see a reduction in their sales. And also that there will be a stigma associated with these sales to dubious or dangerous customers, which will also work as a mitigating factor, much like it has worked in landmines. And also because of the globalized nature of the small arms industry, we are also promoting the idea that a country that has ratified the treaty, that part of its responsibilities will be to not sell weapons to countries that have not ratified. So we're very hopeful that there will be a reduction in international transfers of small arms,
yes.
But our timeline is definitely much, much longer.
Yes, John was explaining that landmines are now not being used as much as they were before in war, but it's hard to see countries not using guns in conflict. Do you ever see that day?
I think that governments will always insist on their need for guns, but what we see at the moment is that all countries are way overarmed, and as a result, we see leakage from those arsenals. For example, in the Pacific region, we know that the vast majority of weapons that are used in crime and in violence, even among civilians, are weapons that originally came from government stockpiles. And that's because the arsenals are so insecure, the officials are so corrupt, and because governments have so many weapons. So I don't personally expect that governments will ever agree to give up using or owning guns. I do expect them to move towards an acceptance that it's legitimate for them to have much smaller and much more secure arsenals. And also, at the moment, the people who come to the international meetings are officials of the Department of Defense, the police, customs. They are guys for whom guns are a normal part of their lives.
Yes, it's the culture, isn't it?
Exactly. Whereas we are pushing governments to bring in the Department of Health, the Department of Women's Rights, the Department of Education, because those officials are going to be experts in the damaging effects. So we're trying to persuade governments to take a holistic view within their own context and to recognize that actually the cost far outweighs the benefit that they're getting.
Yes. John Rodsted, have you used that strategy in your negotiations on either landmines or cluster bombs?
I'm hearing Rebecca saying almost a parallel draft of what we did with the Mines Treaty and the Cluster Bombs Treaty. The hard part about this is, you know, what effectively you're trying to do is to get the axe murderer to put down the axe. And, you know, it's the governments that actually license people to build the guns. It's the governments who supply weapons around the world. Now, you can't walk down to the local Victoria Market in Melbourne and buy yourself a Kalashnikov for $45, but you certainly can on the Pakistan-Afghan border.
Yeah.
And you can walk into any market in Yemen or Angola, and you can just pick this stuff up wholesale. Now, the fact that this stuff exists and you can get hold of it means it will be sold. It was the same deal with landmines. As long as these weapons are in existence, they will be used.
For sure.
Yeah, and trying to make an argument also about universal human rights, like to say people have the right to live free from violence, but there's a lot of governments saying guns are part of our culture and therefore we're not going to do something about it. And you're kind of saying, what, people in your culture have less of a right to safety, especially in regions like the Middle East, like Pakistan, for example, as John mentioned. Governments are very reluctant to agree that the risk of death for their citizens should be reduced to the same extent as it is in places like Britain or Australia or other countries of the developed world.
John, I'm interested, how compelling has death been as a negotiating tool in the negotiation of this ban?
It's a really tough thing to convince governments of, because we try and bring a field reality into a political process. Now, my real work environment has been working in places that are at war or just when wars are finished. One of the problems that you've got in these negotiations is 80% of the people who turn up are lawyers, and they are so removed from reality in the field of what goes on in a country awash with small arms or landmines or cluster bombs. So from an NGO or civil society point of view, we've got to come in, we've got to educate these people.
So, John, a ban on landmines, a ban on cluster bombs. What's next on your horizon?
Oh, I really like what Rebecca's doing. I mean, it's the next logical step. When we took on the mines issue 15 years ago and we got a treaty 11 years ago, and then the clusters issue, for very, very specific reasons, because of the legacy that's created by the use of these things. It's not what they do in a military sense, it's what they do after that military utility is over. Now, it's exactly the same, really, for the small arms situation. If you want to wash your country with guns during a conflict so everybody can be de facto militia, that's one thing. The point is, peace eventually comes.
Yes.
And then what have you got? What do you win?
Yes.
You win a country that's full of arms. You win a completely destabilized environment where the rule of the gun is what takes over. So how do you actually govern a country? where the government's created that scenario.
That was John Rodsted, who has been an integral part of the international campaign to ban landmines, the team that won the 1997 Nobel Peace Prize, just been in Dublin helping to negotiate the ban on cluster bombs. John, as always, great to have you as part of the program. Thank you very much for joining us from Norway.
Lovely to talk to you, Chris. Good luck, Rebecca.
That was Gua from this week's CD, Ceasefire. An aptly named inclusion as we talk about the campaign against small arms and light weapons. We'll tell you where you can find out more about the Ceasefire CD later in the program. You're listening to Radio New Internationalist, coming to you through radios, computers and iPods around the world, like the one you're listening to now. And if you want to hear the perspectives of any of today's guests again, or you've missed the earlier parts of this program, just jump onto your computer and visit the New Internationalist website, www.newint.org. Then click on Radio New Internationalist. I'm Chris Richards, and today we're talking with Rebecca Peters from the International Action Network on Small Arms. So, Rebecca, what's in a gun?
Well, some guns are highly sophisticated, finely engineered pieces of work, and some guns have a lot of fancy, elaborate carving on the outside and are very prized by collectors. But fundamentally, a gun is a pretty simple machine. The explosive sends out this projectile at such a high speed that it is able to travel a long distance and penetrate the skin and the organs of human beings or animals. And they're simple to manufacture in a factory. There are guns that are homemade, and in some rural parts of West Africa and in Pakistan, there are people who make guns by hand. But one of the reasons why they're so easily available and so cheap is because they're fundamentally simple, and that is part of the problem.
I was struck by what you were saying before about that perception that people who have guns in their homes think of themselves as more secure when in fact they're not. I wonder why that perception has arisen.
I think it's partly because people have watched too many Hollywood movies.
In the poor world as well, do you think?
Oh, yeah. I mean, the fundamental story of the fight between good and evil, often the David and Goliath. I think the myth of the good guy triumphing over, well, it's not a myth, of course, that very often the good guy does triumph over the bad guy. But that notion is very deeply cherished all around the world. And certainly the exposure to simplistic stories of good triumphing over evil is common all around the world in whatever kind of exposure to television people have. But unfortunately, the truth is that the power to kill is contained in that weapon, regardless of whether the trigger is being pulled by me in a battle against a bad guy, by my 4-year-old son who finds it by accident, by my 12-year-old son who is showing off to his friend, by me when in the middle of the night I hear a noise and I think it's a bad guy breaking into my house. And in fact, it's my teenage daughter coming home late from a party. And therefore, we find that research shows that having a gun in your house increases by several times the probability that someone in your house will die, either by homicide, suicide, or accident.
Yes, I mean, part of the mythology is that other people have guns too, and you need to protect yourself with a gun from those guns. On an international level, the claim is being made at the moment there's a gun culture that is integral to Arab society. And I understand that your organisation has done a recent survey which dispels that particular mythology. Tell us about that.
Yes, this was a survey that was done by the Middle East and North African Action Network on Small Arms, where our members are frustrated that so often their governments say, well, there's nothing that can be done about guns and there's no need to do anything about guns in our societies because they are just part of our culture and we accept that. So our members did a survey of young people in Gaza, the West Bank, in Lebanon and in Sudan, and basically asked them their opinions about the proliferation of guns in their society, and found that the overwhelming majority said, we don't accept that guns are a part of our culture. We want to see fewer guns in our society. And that was significant because the survey was among young people, and young people in the Middle East, their values are different from the older generation. So it's been very significant for us to communicate to government officials in the Middle East to say, look, your idea that guns are normal and part of your culture, that value is not shared by young people in your societies. They're thinking of their own generation, the officials. They're not thinking of young people. And it is young people, of course, who will be the society as time goes by. And hopefully they will retain those attitudes as they move into positions of power. And the notion that it may be normal for guns to be everywhere in the Middle East, but just because it's normal doesn't mean it should remain that way.
But there were lots of guns in Beirut, Lebanon's capital, 50 years ago this month, when the United States invaded Lebanon for the first time. The Marines who landed came face to face with an unusual kind of enemy. Author Alistair Susie has been researching the invasion for a book on Lebanon that he's writing at the moment. So take us to the beaches of Beirut on the 15th of July 1958, Ali. What did those troops see when they landed?
Well, if you can picture the D-Day landing craft in World War II, and there's naval planes flying overhead, you've seen Saving Private Ryan. In terms of the similarities, when those landing craft hit the beaches, the lids fly open and floods of Marines come out. Now, there was about 2,000 of these Marines. These guys were in their 20s, but they were teenagers, a lot of these guys as well. And for a lot of them, you know, this was their first campaign, and they're expecting to be met with bullets and bombs. These guys hit the beach. They're absolutely shocked to discover that there's girls in bikinis and there's people playing on the beaches and kids playing with their sand buckets and even ice cream vendors as well. And there's just sort of Beiruties who are having a swim, and some of them taking their families down to the beach. And as I said, there was girls in bikinis as well.
So they didn't know that they were going to be attacked by the US. And obviously the US troops, their perception and their reality were completely different worlds away. How could they have got that so wrong? What was going on at the time to actually indicate to them that they would be met with hostilities?
Well, I'll take you back in order to give you some sort of background on this, because it's quite a complicated sort of political situation that leads up to all this.
Please, Ellie.
Lebanon, it became a sort of independent country in 1943 when it threw off the shackles of the French Mandate. Then followed the so-called National Pact, which was the covenant that set Lebanon's political system, that of a sectarian democracy, where, among other things, the president should be a Christian, Maronite, and the prime minister a Sunni Muslim. And the object of government from Lebanon becoming an independent country was to balance this system, which was weighted in favor of the Christians. And so when Kamil Shamoun became president in 1952, following his predecessor, the first president of Lebanon, Bashar al-Khoury, we saw this balance start to shift as Shamoun became very pro-Western. And this pro-Westernism, or ultra-pro-Westernism conviction that Shamoun had, it was in part a reaction to the rise of Egypt's charismatic leader Nasser and the forces of Arab nationalism, which he harnessed, capturing the imagination of Muslims across the Arab world, including Lebanon at that time. Shamoun signed up to this so-called Eisenhower Doctrine from President Eisenhower in 1957, which gave US protection to countries in the Middle East threatened by international communism. So you had Egypt in talks with the Soviet Union, and you had this stirring of Arab nationalism. This frightened the Americans, and it frightened the Christian president of Lebanon and his government, because they thought that communism was going to spread into the Middle East. Of course, this wasn't true. There was nothing communist about Nasser, and there was nothing communist really about Arab nationalism. But by the time it came to 1957, and Shamoun had signed up to this Eisenhower Doctrine, this was a slap in the face to Muslims in Lebanon. I mean, this angered them, because he was getting in tow with America, and he was being too pro-Western, and this was upsetting the balance, because all the problems that you see in Lebanon, even till now, it's because this balance that they've had since 1943 has been disrupted. So by 1957, there was sort of great animosity towards Shamoun from largely the Sunni Muslims who resented Shamoun's pro-Westernism, and others in Lebanon, including the political leaders from the Druze, for example, and other Sunnis who were shafted by Shamoun in the 1957 elections, were also against him. Even some fellow Maronites were against President Shamoun, who of course was a Maronite himself. And then these tensions came to a head in July. Civil conflict was underway in July 1958, and when the Iraqi regime was overthrown in a bloody coup on July 14, this caused a sheikh in Shamoun to invoke the Eisenhower Doctrine, causing the Marines to land amid swimmers and sun-tailors.
Since then, there's been another invasion. In fact, peaceniks are now commentating that the US could be lining up for a third invasion. Have you followed the parallels between those first, second, and imminently third invasion through?
Yeah, it's important to note that it's too simplistic to say this was Christian versus Muslim. It's 1958. The conflict wasn't one based on religious grounds. There were actually some dissident Maronites who were fighting with the Sunni Muslims, and there were some anti-Nasser Muslims who were in the camp with the Christian Maronites.
Mm.
So it can't be simplified to saying that that was a religious war in 58. And that's why it actually ended quite quickly, because it lasted just for several months. The 75 to 90 Lebanese civil war, now that went on for 15 years, and that was far more complicated, and it included both sort of religious and political strife. At the moment, it's not really about, religious ground. It's about power and politics. But you see, sometimes the problem that I think we have in the West especially is we like to simplify things and say that it's Christian v. Muslim.
Going back to 58, we've got a situation where the troops have landed. What do they do once they've landed? How many people are injured and killed during this dispute?
Well, there was one casualty, a man called Sergeant James Nettles, who was shot through the throat by a sniper. He was the only US casualty there. There were a few wounded, but James Nettles was the only man to die in the conflict. These guys didn't understand what the hell was going on. At the height of its troop occupation, there was 14,000 American troops in Beirut.
Wow.
Now, Lebanon's a small place, and Beirut's not a very big place either. 14,000 of them. I mean, not just Marines, but guys from the Airborne Division. And speaking to them at length, as I have done, even today, they couldn't quite grasp what was going on. They were shot at times, but they weren't allowed to shoot back unless it was a matter of life and death. But they said that they would be around doing their duties and there would be snipers trying to pick them off. But it was in such a haphazard kind of way that after speaking to one guy who said they just weren't very good shots most of the time. And he said they would go through periods where there was nothing really happening. There's so many stories of, for example, the soldiers starting to get shot at. One of them throws himself underneath an ammunition truck full of ammunition. And he said to me, thinking about it, he said, that's probably not the best place to hide. But because of the bizarreness of this whole conflict, there's lots of these kind of anecdotes, because it wasn't a battle, really.
What did the US actually achieve in Lebanon?
Well, in one sense, it was a kind of positive sense. The American presence actually gave the factions a chance to stand down and to stop the hostilities, because it wasn't going anywhere. However, on the negative side, it gave America, firstly, a false sense of security. The Americans went in there, and because of what happened, in terms of, that there was very little conflict, they thought, well, the Lebanese don't have a stomach for a civil conflict.
And clearly they did, and the second invasion showed that very clearly. We're coming up to a situation in America at the moment where legislation is passing the American Congress, and this might indeed show an intention by America to invade Lebanon for a third time. What's the background of that?
Well, I mean, I have to say that from what I know, I think it would be very unlikely that the Americans would invade Lebanon for several reasons. The first reason is because they're too bogged down in Iraq and Afghanistan. The second thing is that this isn't 1958. You know, one of the reasons why there wasn't very much attack or hostilities on the Americans was because I think that they were scared of them at that time. And they can be assured that if they were to invade this time, it would be a complete bloodbath because things have changed, of course, over the last 50 years. And I have to say, I would be extremely surprised if that happened. I think they've got more chance of bombing Iran, and even that, I think, is not very likely.
Good to hear, Ali. I'm wondering what the Lebanese people themselves are thinking on this occasion, and how will they mark this anniversary?
The Lebanese just get on with it. They don't tend to think about the sort of worries of conflict or politics as much as we think that they do. People in the West, especially, we talk about it constantly. The people in Lebanon, they just get on with their lives. If something happens, it happens. And when it stops, they carry on. And that's what they do.
That was Alastair Susie, who's a regular contributor to New Internationalist magazine. Ali, you're writing a book at the moment on this very topic. When's it out?
Well, it probably won't be out until maybe next year. There's still a lot of work I've got to do on it. But it'll be very soon, I hope.
Good on you, Ali. Thanks very much for joining us tonight.
Chris.
Bye for now.
Okay, Chris. Cheers.
And it's also time to say goodbye to you too, Rebecca Peters. Thank you so much for being on the program today.
And thanks, Chris.
Rebecca, for people who want to follow up the information that you've been talking about today, where will they go?
Well, a very good place to start is our website, which is www.iansa.org. IANSA is I-A-N-S-A for International Action Network on Small Arms. And we've got links there to the UN meeting, to this information from the survey in the Middle East, the results of the Brazilian, the great work that's been going on there, information about lots of different countries and regions, and also information about the hundreds of organizations that make up our international network. So that's the best place to start.
That was Rebecca Peters, who's the director of the International Action Network on Small Arms. Great work, Rebecca. Good luck with it.
Thank you, Chris, and thanks to Radio New Internationalist.
Bye for now.
Okay, bye.
Bye-bye. The music that we've been playing tonight comes from the Riverboat Records series in the World Music Network's wonderful collection of inspiring music from all corners of the globe. Today's CD is called Ceasefire. Inspired by peace talks in Sudan between the Muslim North and the predominantly Christian South. Reflecting the hope by both sides for a peaceful future, Emmanuel Jal, a Christian rapper from the South, got together with Abdul Gadir Salim, a Muslim musician from the North, to show what colourful, dynamic sounds are produced when two different cultures work side by side. Find out more on the World Music Network's website, www.worldmusic.net. Or by visiting the New Internationalist website, www.newint.org, which is also where you'll find a copy of this program just waiting for you to download from our audio archives. And iPodders, if you want to subscribe to the program, the New Internationalist website's where it's at. That address again, www.newint.org. Radio New Internationalist is produced at 3CR in Melbourne, Australia, and distributed via satellite on the Community Radio Network. Thanks to the Community Broadcasting Foundation for their financial assistance and the Community Broadcasting Association of Australia for sending this program to a wireless near you. The associate producers for this program are Rachel Maher and Eleanor McInerney. I'm Chris Richards. Let's chat again next week.